Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I first became familiar with Elizabeth Warren when she was a law professor at Harvard and wrote a book called The Two-Income Trap and really described what was happening to the middle class in America. I got to work with her when I was in the White House, and she helped put together the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and watched as she got elected to the Senate in Massachusetts. And most Americans know her as a firebrand populist taking on the big banks and Wall Street. What fewer people know is her own personal story, which is really compelling and helps inform your understanding of the positions that she takes. She just wrote a book called This Fight Is Our Fight that is in many ways biographical and compelling for that reason. She and I had a chance to sit down today in Washington on the eve of several momentous battles in which she will take part to talk about her life, to talk about her views, and to talk about where we are as a country. Elizabeth Warren, so good to see you.
Oh, good to see you, David.
I really loved your book, and the reason that I loved it is the way you interwove your own story into the fabric of everyone else's stories. So I want to start there. I want to start in Norman, Oklahoma.
Yep.
I know you're only the second most famous person who came from Norman, Oklahoma, because James Garner came from Oklahoma.
And my third grade teacher was his aunt. And James Garner came to my third grade class. I still remember he jumped over a brick wall. He was the handsomest man I have ever seen.
That must have been in the old Maverick days when he was on TV.
That's when it was. He was on Maverick. And we argued afterwards, the little girls in the front row, who he looked directly at. And I'm still to this day sure he looked directly at me and smiled.
Ah, life changing.
I carry it in my heart.
So tell me about Norman.
So we lived in the last house on the last street in town, and the edge of this small town, and then behind us were wheat fields, and the wheat fields ran to Midwest City, which was the next little town, and then beyond that was Oklahoma City. And it was a town that my folks moved there because my daddy was working at that time. He was selling household goods, paint, things like that, at a store in Oklahoma City. And it was cheaper to live in Norman, and he caught the bus every day. And they were hopeful that the schools would be good and my brothers might go to the University of Oklahoma. And, you know, it was all about family.
Uh-huh. And you talked about living on the ragged edge of the middle class. That's, I think, the phrase that you use. Tell me what the ragged edge was like.
So we were a paycheck-to-paycheck family. You know, from my youngest memories, it was always my mother doing the calculations on what you could pay for this week, what you needed to wait until next week, when you bought a gallon of milk, when you bought a half a gallon of milk, based on how much money there was. I, to this day, remember my mother. Every time I get sick or one of my brothers would get sick, she'd lay her hand on your forehead and, you know, give you that mother look and assess how hot you were. And then she'd stop and do the calculation from Dr. Buffington's office, and that is how much she'd paid down on the doctor bill and whether or not she could reasonably take you back to the doctor again, given that the bill wasn't paid off.
Yeah, I guess this gave you a rough measure of how much you were worth, too, huh?
You know, it gave me a measure early on that families hold together, and they do the absolute best they can. And that's how I always saw it. My mother, my daddy, they were there for the four of us, my three older brothers, and for me. And they would have done anything they could for us. That was just what it meant to be a mom or a dad.
You mentioned illness, and you write in the book about your father's illness. He had a heart attack when you were 12,
right.
And that how life-changing that was for you.
Right. So we'd been, like I said, paycheck to paycheck. Daddy had had different jobs. There were times we were a little more ahead, a little behind.
And your mom was working in the home at the time.
And mom was a stay-at-home mom the whole time. And by the time I was 12, my three older brothers, they'd all headed off to the military. And so it was just mom and dad and me. And we'd moved to Oklahoma City. And things looked like they were kind of on the upswing. Daddy was selling carpeting by then. And we had a nice station wagon, had a house in Oklahoma City. And then Daddy had a heart attack, and it all turned upside down in what felt like the blink of an eye. And, you know, it's one of those, so Daddy's sick, and you've got all the worries around.
Let me just interrupt you for one second. Was it a sudden thing? Had he been ill? Or?
No, he hadn't been sick. My daddy was a rock. I mean, I don't think my daddy that I ever remember had ever been sick, had ever missed a day of work, at least not that I ever knew. And he'd been working on the car and been under the car. And he came in and sat down at the kitchen table. And I was downstairs, and I remember he looked waxy. I don't know how else to describe it, kind of this odd gray look. And
Must have been scary.
He's looking off into the middle distance, and then my mother comes in and starts in on what's the matter with you? What's the matter? What's the matter? What's the matter? And it's like a fight between the two of them. And finally, she decides she's going to take him to the hospital. And they leave me at home. Then find out that they said he's had a heart attack. And they keep him in the hospital for about a week. My Aunt Bea and Uncle Stanley take me up there. My mother stays up there with him. And then when he comes home, it's all that chaos of when he was in the hospital. You know, people coming in and out and people bringing covered dishes. So there was food for my mother and me to eat. But it's when he comes home that it all changes. It's that long, long period that he just sat. And my daddy never sat. My daddy's up and moving and always doing, always fixing something around the house, and he just sat. And we go a long stretch. There's no money coming in. We lose the family station wagon. And every night when I go to bed, I hear my mother cry in the next room. She always waits. I never saw her cry during this time, but I hear her every night. And then I hear them start to talk about the house and how we're going to lose the house. And it's when I understood how just one bad thing can happen to a family that works hard, a family that does everything they can and just bam. And it's like the boat flips over and everybody's out in the water.
Now, obviously, you said before she had to calculate whether she'd pay down the doctor bill. So you guys didn't have insurance at the time.
You know, I don't know. They may have had some insurance. I honestly don't know. I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, not enough. And the thing is, it's both halves when somebody gets sick like that. It's not only that the medical bills stack up. It's there's no money coming in. There's no money to pay for groceries. There's no money to make the mortgage payment or the car payment. There's nothing.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that really moved me was your description of the sort of psychology of that. For your dad, your mom went went to work,
yep.
And this sense you said of sort of failure that he wasn't living up to his responsibilities.
Yeah, my daddy always worked. He always worked. I mean, he had a job and didn't always, sometimes he lost that job, but he was a man who was always trying to make it better. You know what I mean? He fixed everything at home. He mowed the lawn. He weeded the flower bed. He put in a garden. He was always out there trying to take care of the rest of us. And when he had a heart attack, and when there's no money coming in, and when we lost that car, and when we're on the edge, just had our toes on the line about losing our house, my daddy lost something of himself. And when my mother finally went to work, there was this enormous defeat in my daddy's face over this, that she was unhappy, she was scared, I was scared. And he hadn't been able to stop all of that.
Yeah. You know, I think what's always lost in these discussions, it is certainly important, and you've been a champion for this forever, that people earn a living wage and are able to support their families. But we also define ourselves by what we do. I mean, it's the first question people ask each other. It's like, what do you do? And it is soul crushing to be idle. It is soul crushing to not be doing something that is constructive and meaningful.
To not be able to do the things that matter most to you, to take care of your family, to be able to take care of others, to take care of yourself. It's as if you're redefined by the failure to bring home a decent paycheck.
I don't want to leap ahead because your story is so good and I want to pursue it. But just as an aside on this, you know, there's all this discussion now about universal basic income and sort of strengthening this social compact and so on, which I think is in the 21st century a worthy discussion to have, an important discussion to have. But it strikes me that it's not a substitute for also opportunity. And, and I'll ask you about this later, but I hear some of the leaders in Silicon Valley say, well, we need this because we're going to be automating all these jobs and people will be idled and, you know, they'll have to live. And it seems to me just that's only half the equation. You know, I don't think we want to tell people, you know what, you've lost your utility, but but here's a check. So I think, you know, that's one of the great challenges for us as a society is how do we make sure that people have opportunity and productive work to do?
You know, it's so interesting you'd frame it that way, David, because the way I see this is that is one of the central functions of government, is it sets the rules that determine opportunity and who's going to get that opportunity. I mean, that's kind of the core of how I think about this. If we're going to have real opportunity in the 21st century, not just for those at the top, not just for those who run the billion-dollar business and take home these great salaries, but for all of us, then it's kind of two halves to the equation for me. Half of it is about the opportunities, one by one, how we build those, the investment in education, for example, how
Which
all of
more
our
important
kids,
now than ever.
Exactly, more important than ever, how all of our kids get a real chance to get started, and we should talk more about that. But the other half is how it is that we build an economy that continues to produce opportunities, not just for those at the top, but for everyone. And every time I hear people talk about this, and I talk about this in the book, This Yes. Fight is Our Fight. I talk about the government sets the rules, and the rules determine, in effect, who's going to get to profit from all of this growth that we have in the economy, how it's going to be distributed, and how those opportunities, are they really going to be opportunities over in China, which are great opportunities for investors here in the United States and around the world, but not so much for workers? Or are we going to have a set of rules that really help build that robust economy here in America? I think of the investments, for example, in infrastructure, not just roads and bridges and water and sewer, which are all powerfully important, but investment in things like cheap and accessible internet service all across the country. You know, there are parts of Western Massachusetts right now where you can't get a signal. Yes. Now, can you believe that?
Parts of southwestern Michigan, too.
Exactly. How do you build a 21st century economy if you can't get online?
So
right?
let me ask you. Okay. I let's just.
You know, I always
this,
warm up when we start on this policy stuff.
I know you do. But here's my question.
Sure.
You come from a state that's lost over decades lots of manufacturing. Yep. Massachusetts. It's also the hub of technology.
Yep.
And a lot of those technologists are developing ways for corporations and smaller businesses to rationalize what they do so that because of robots, because of artificial intelligence, computers, it just takes fewer people to do the work. And that is consonant with sort of the theory of capitalism that, you know, you want to maximize your profit. But there's collateral, there are collateral impacts of that. I mean, the studies suggest that that's where like 80% of the job loss is going to come in the coming decades. So what do we do about that? Because you're not going to, as the technologist in Massachusetts will tell you, the genie's not going back into the bottle. But that seems like a real tension in our democracy and in our economic system.
So I want to make an argument here that we look at this as if it's a singular event. My goodness, look at the changes that technology are causing in this country. Let's just back up. We've been a changing economy from the very beginning. You know, we started out as agrarian and fur trapping, right? And then big changes. Look what the Industrial Revolution changed in this country. Look at the things that went from it took 1,000 guys with hand shovels to it suddenly took, you know, a couple of guys with steam shovels, and then we went beyond steam shovels. Yes, there's change. There's always going to be change. That's the deal. That's what makes it exciting to be in this country. It's what makes it exciting to be in this world. The question is, who's going to write the rules around what happens as everything changes? So let me just give you an example. 1930s, we wrote a basic social contract around employment. And it was premised on the just unspoken, nobody had to write it down, but you're going to work for one employer for almost all your life, maybe two. You're going to work 40 hours a week, you know, kind of the basic period. And that meant we could put a lot of the benefits that people need, a lot of the safety net, a lot of the building toward a future, toward retirement, we could put it in the employment relationship with put the center of it with the employer. And that way we get a good distribution of opportunity and security for wide, wide swaths of Americans. That's just not true anymore. And yet what's happening is nobody's talking about much. I shouldn't say nobody, but not many are talking about how we need to rewrite that basic contract. And I'll give you one example, Uber drivers. Did you know that right now, as a matter of law, if Uber drivers are independent contractors, as Uber keeps claiming they are, so-called 1099 workers, that's the kind of tax return tax filing they get, they can't talk to each other about, gee, let's bargain together with the company to get some changes in our benefits and our wages.
And ever was needed, it's among Uber drivers.
No kidding. I mean, that's the whole point. So we have a set of laws that right now would treat that as an antitrust violation because if they are independent contractors, that are those are a whole bunch of separate businesses and they can't collude against the company Uber. And that makes no sense at all. So I say that by way of saying the rules, the basic legal rules and understanding of the relationship is negotiated, let's be blunt, right here in Washington, D.C. And right now, it's being captured by all those who've already made it big. It's being captured by the money interests. So the rules, the discussion around it is always about how it is that we protect the profitability of those at the top and not about how we think about how this is going to work for most of America.
I hear you on that, and that's there's no doubt that there's a lot of concentrated power in this town, and you've come head-to-head with them on many,
butted heads more than once.
On many occasions, and I think in the next few months and years even more so. I do think what you say is partially true, which is that we had the Industrial Revolution. It was profound. But nothing compared to the scope and scale of the pace at which technology is advancing. Now it's churning at a faster rate than ever and across more industries at once and more businesses at once. A lot of middle management jobs, for example, are going to be done by computers now. And this is true in every realm of our lives, and communications is a big example. Mm-hmm. Technology is churning so fast, it's hard for us to get our arms around it fast enough. So the rule writing is certainly important, but there are, I mean, we also need a national strategy for how we convert the, where are these 40% of Americans who are going to lose their job in the next couple of decades because of technology? Where are they going in our economy?
Yep.
Who's the people who, you talk about Uber drivers,
right.
They can organize till the cows come
right.
home, but when there are driverless cars,
it's not going to matter.
It's not going to matter.
But you know, that goes back though. I'm just going to make the point again. It goes back to where we make these core investments. So for example, forever, we've kind of taken the position in America, you finish your education at eighth grade, a century and a half ago, right? At 12th grade, at maybe 2 years of technical school or 4 years of college, maybe even a graduate degree, and thank you very much, we're done. That's not going to work in the 21st century. You know, people repaint their houses every 5 years. They're going to have to repaint their brains every 5 years. The notion in a world of great technological change that people can sort of box up that they have their education at a certain point in time and they're done, it's just wrong. And it means, that's why I go back to the rules made here in Washington, the kind of investments we need to make to keep people current, to keep them in the game is going to be about lifetime learning.
Right.
It's going to be about lifetime change.
That's why
change.
I say we need a national strategy for how we deal with this. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Senator Elizabeth Warren. I'm glad you raised education because it's a good segue to get back to your story, because you moved to Oklahoma City and you went to a very, very good high school that also seemed life-changing to you and your experience. Talk a little bit about that, because it didn't seem like there were class distinctions in Norman, but there were in Oklahoma City. And you went to high school with a group of kids, not all of whom were struggling as your family struggled.
Yeah. You know, when I went to high school was when I really started seeing the kids, how many of them were college bound, how many smart kids there were in school. And that's when I got my chance. And my chance was debate. I didn't belong anywhere in high school. I guess I'm like a lot of kids. You know, I was always tall. I was as tall then as I am now. I was even skinnier and awkward and knew my parents didn't have much, not as much as most of the other kids in that high school. And I had no place where I belonged. I couldn't, I couldn't sing. I couldn't join the chorus. I couldn't play a musical instrument. I couldn't join the band. I tried softball and got hit in the face like every time.
Good preparation for politics.
Yeah, exactly. No kidding, man. The ball just bang right in the face. And so I ended up in speech class. Because it always kind of seemed like to me with speech, and I don't say this, all the speech majors can stop listening for one second. It like seemed I didn't need like any talent. What I really need was just some grit. It was scary to stand up in front of a bunch of people, but you just stand up and do it. And I really didn't have to stay on key or catch the ball before it hit me in the face. And from there, I got exposed to debate. And again, I just felt like, okay, the one thing I got going for me is, man, I can sink my teeth in and, you know, hang on to an argument and learn that I could even think on my feet. And debate was my chance. It was my chance to get in there with the smart kids and the kids whose parents were getting them ready for college and to compete, to be part of it. And for that, I'll always be grateful.
And you, on your own initiative, because your mom was skeptical about the notion of you going to college. She didn't think that was worth thinking about or attainable.
Right. Well, look, she was skeptical even about debate. Mm-hmm. I mean, she pointed out to me on a pretty regular basis that boys don't like girls who argue. And my mother thought, and God bless her, she thought my best chance was to marry a good provider, that would be what would keep me safe for the rest of my life. And every time I didn't move in that direction, every time I talked about how I wanted to be a school teacher, every time I talked about, you know, I'm going to this debate tournament this weekend, every time I pushed back, my mother would remind me. That's
Well, probably colored by her own experience.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So but I was really touched by this image of you running home and opening up the mailbox to see if you had heard from you on your own with your own savings from babysitting and the other stuff you were doing. You mailed off a couple of college applications.
Yep. I looked through a book and talked to some of the other kids and found two schools that said affirmatively they had debate scholarships. And so I took some of my babysitting money. I went down to the 7-Eleven and bought money orders and so that I had an application fee and sent it off to those two schools. That was it. All my hopes were riding on the two.
Northwestern and George Washington.
Northwestern and George Washington. And then once I'd applied, I'd run home every day at lunch and see if the mail had come in. I'd round that corner. We were the second house in from the corner, and we had this little mailbox out in front that had the flag on it. And I'd round the corner to see if the mail had arrived, because you could tell by the flag, and then jerk open that box to see if there was anything for me. And just, God, day after day, it stretched into weeks. There was nothing for me. And, you know, my other friends in high school are already in some place and already talking about where they're going to go to college. And I'm still running home at lunch to see what's there. And then the letters arrived, both of them, on the same day. And I ripped them
open. Fat envelopes, right?
Fat envelopes. That's how you knew.
Fat envelopes versus the thin ones.
That's exactly right. And, of course, all I'm looking for is the bottom line on the dollars.
Yeah.
And
did your folks know that you had done this?
By this time, they did. They didn't know at the beginning. But then I found out you had to fill out a financial aid form. And I couldn't do it without help. And that's when I went to my folks about this. And my mother was not happy. And, you know, we're sitting at the dinner table, and boy, she's really giving it to me about this is not right, this is not the right direction. And finally my daddy said, let her try, Polly. And my daddy spoke very little at home, but like lots of people who don't speak very much, people listen when he does. Mm-hmm. And he said it in a pretty clear, we're shutting this one down. And then that was it. They filled out the form. So when I found out, wow, we we really don't have much money. And then we sent it off and nobody talked about it at home. I mean, this went on for months. It just didn't exist. I didn't talk about what the kids were saying at school about going to school. I didn't talk about GW or Northwestern. We just did, I'd sent in the paperwork and that was it. And then you just waited.
And GW gave you
more money.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And enough, more money.
Enough to go.
Enough to go.
So you went and then you left.
I know.
And so your mother's voice must have been ringing in your head because your high school sweetheart or
well, the first boy that dated me and the first boy who dumped me. I'm not sure what the word is for that guy, but
fickle maybe.
But he came back over a weekend. He'd graduated from college. He was 3.5 years older than I was. And he had already graduated and was working down in Houston on the NASA space project and worked for IBM. Oh, wow, IBM. Regular salary, health insurance, the whole thing.
Your mom's dream.
It was.
Yeah.
And Jim came back over a Labor Day weekend, ended up proposing to me, and it took me about a nanosecond to say yes. And I gave it all up. I gave up my scholarship. I gave up college. I gave up my dream of being a school teacher. I now had the prize. I had a good provider, and I loved him. And I thought, this is it. And we got married in the space of a few weeks. I made my wedding dress. My cousin Susan was my maid of honor. I made her dress too. And then we moved down to Houston, and I started working, temp, mm-hmm. where they'd move you around to different offices. And God, that's when I found out about the University of Houston, that it was about a 35-minute drive away, maybe something like that. I'd never seen it. But one of the people at work had told me about it and said, you want to be a teacher. How come you're not going back to school? And, I said, I can't afford it.
$50 huh?
bucks a semester. Yeah. And, man, I got home that night and said, Jim, here's the deal. I can go back to school. And, of course, he immediately raised costs. I said, whoa. $50 a semester. I could cover that waiting tables mm-hmm. one night a week. And so I ended up going back to school.
So you didn't give up your dream of being a teacher?
I didn't. But, this goes back to the core point. Yeah, I worked hard. And here I am, the graduate of a commuter college that costs $50 a semester, and I end up as a United States senator. Mm-hmm. That's because America invested in opportunity for mm-hmm. kids like me.
Yeah, and it's disturbing now when you look at all these public colleges and how states are making fewer investments in them. Tuition is going up.
Yep.
Accessibility to these institutions is becoming much more difficult.
Did you know that 70% of kids who graduate from state universities have to borrow money now to get there? And here's the twist of the knife. The federal government that lends them that money is making a profit off the kids who've got to borrow money to go to school. These kids end up with thousands and thousands of dollars in debt, depending on what they do, sometimes tens of thousands. I even meet young people today who have $100,000 in student mm-hmm. loan debt. And it's exactly upside down. The kids who are born into families that can pay for all of it, college costs one price. But for kids who are born into families that can't just write a check for school, the price is higher, and the federal government is charging an extra fee to them. You can't get much more wrong than that in America. And I say that not just on economics, it's on values. When I was a kid, I really felt like America wanted me to succeed. I mean, that they were investing in the schools that I went to. They were investing in creating this economy that was going to work,
right.
That was going to create these opportunities. Lord, when I graduated, I had partly from the GW days, an NDEA loan, National Defense Education Act. You know, part of what they would do, not only did they subsidize that loan, the United States government, they did loan forgiveness for anybody who worked, you'll love this, in the national defense. Mm-hmm. And do you know one of the things that was considered national defense? Being a public school teacher.
Yeah.
And I was a special needs teacher, yeah. So they gave me an extra bump, 15% off a year.
Yeah, let me ask you quickly about that. Because I have a child with special needs, you know that. So I have a special place in my heart for people who work with kids who have special needs. What led you there?
Oh, God, I love that work. So I knew I wanted to be a public school teacher from second grade on. That was Mrs. Lee. Mrs. Lee was my second grade teacher, and I loved her. She gave the best hugs in the world. She's the one who opened the door, who took me aside and told me that it was possible that I could I could do this too. And I still I can remember what her face looked like when I announced later that to Mrs. Lee that I was going to be a school teacher like her. So that was my dream all the way through. I went off to GW, and I show up in my first classes as a freshman. And this is where the door gets kicked open. And I end up in a class that starts talking about the range of kids who are in public schools or who should be able to get to public schools. And I start learning more about special needs kids and about how differential diagnosis, how you understand in different ways of teaching. And I was just immediately drawn in that direction. So it was college. It opened another door for me, another way to see the world. And from there, it was never work.
It's hard, though. I mean,
it's hard.
Those kids require a lot of care and attention and love.
But it's from the heart. I mean, it was the best work I ever did was with little kids.
So what provoked you to go into the law?
I got pregnant. And in those days,
lots of people get pregnant, and I know we have lots of lawyers, but they don't all become lawyers.
Exactly. But that actually is the line. When I got pregnant while I was doing special needs work, the school and Jim made it pretty clear that, I was going to have to quit. So there I was. I was home with a little baby, and I really tried hard to stay home. I mean, I really did. I thought it was the right thing. Back in those days, there was this whole, you know, this is what mamas were supposed to do. We stay home if you could afford it. And Jim kept saying, I'm taking care of the family. We can afford this. And I really tried, and I was really terrible at it. And finally, I came up with the idea of going back to school. And there was a law school that was, again, about a 35, 40, maybe 45-minute drive. It was a public law school. Cost about $460 a semester. And I could go to law school, and it wasn't the same as having a full-time job. And I thought law sounded great. Sounded like you could get out there and fight for people and fight for opportunities. And that's how I ended up in law school. So Amy, my daughter, and I would get up 4 mornings a week and, you know, have our breakfast and pack our lunch. And I would drop her off at the babysitter and headed to law school. And I would attend classes and then race back.
She didn't go with you. She didn't get a degree as well.
She did not get a degree, but I do remember. Oh, listen, I'd zip back because the idea was I'd try to study in the afternoon, which meant I needed to get back. She'd had her lunch. But before she went down for a nap, these are the crucial things you learn when you are a parent and trying to balance it all. And I can remember driving my little Volkswagen, and she's in the back in her car seat, and I would shake her foot the entire way from the babysitter back home because I needed to keep her awake so I could get her into her crib to go down for her naps. But that's how I made it through law school.
So people would be surprised to know that you were a Republican. You
yeah.
you until like the mid-90s, you were a Republican. What drew you to that?
Well,
because listening to you, you're espousing lots of progressive sort of messaging. And I don't mean to make a partisan point, but that doesn't seem consistent with your experience. Doesn't seem consistent necessarily. Now, I know you had brothers in the military, and that may have something to do with it. But
and I was just not very politically active. I mean, I never did anything politically. I voted.
Were your folks? Did they talk about it at all?
Not much.
Mm-hmm.
My Aunt B did, and she was a rock rib Democrat. I was never very politically active. I was a registered Republican when we lived in Pennsylvania. And I felt like by 94, 95, when we move up to Massachusetts, I just felt like this isn't a party that reflects my values. I had kind of been attracted to the physically conservative.
Yeah, because that was the whole Reagan period,
yeah,
the 80s.
And I thought fiscal conservatives is good, right? It's good to have a government that tries to live within its budget. And I was kind of, I thought that made some sense.
It's interesting because in your book, you trace part of what's happened to the country to the sort of very, very steep tax cutting that Reagan did.
Yep. The very steep tax cutting and the turning the big corporations loose again. Deregulation, letting the big banks kind of do whatever they wanted. What could possibly go wrong? And a big part of what's happening by this point in my life is that by the 90s, I'm doing a lot more of the bankruptcy work and a lot more studying about families that have been a lot like mine, families that had looked pretty middle class on the surface, and then one bad medical diagnosis, one job loss, a family breakup, and bang, they were upside down. And those were the families I studied and began to just see the whole world connect up maybe my personal life with public policy.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be right back with Senator Elizabeth Warren. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, this is a pretty active time as we sit here in Washington. And, you know, I guess I should start by asking you about the president. I think he would insist.
Mm-hmm.
And
he wants everyone to talk about him.
He campaigned and he talked about the rigged economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you have in common. You've both talked about the rigged economy. So sort out your divergent paths on this.
Right. So the economy is rigged now. It works better and better for those at the top and worse for everyone else. You've read my book, This Fight is Our Fight, and that's a big part of what I talk about. It's documenting not just how it is now, but how it once was very different. That 1935 to 1980, we really had an economy that worked for everybody, that was working for the upper middle class and the middle class and the working class and the working poor and the poor poor. The pie was getting bigger and everybody was getting more.
Wages grew with the GDP.
That's right. That's right. And how that really changed starting in about 1980 and changes profoundly. And 1980 to 2016, how the GDP keeps going up, but basically the 90% of America gets left out and gets none of the new income growth in this country. Now, that's made a lot of people in this country angry, and justifiably so. Donald Trump tapped that anger, and then he told a story around it. It's their fault. And there was where he pointed his finger, was everybody who doesn't look like you, everybody who doesn't worship like you, everybody who's not the same color as you, everybody who doesn't speak the same language as you, it's their fault. That's the narrative that Donald Trump told. The story I tell, and the story I tell in the book, and the story is that I believe is true, is that the big difference is that people with money have seized our government, our federal government, our national government, and they now make it work for them. And so we've got you know, billionaires and bankers who run the economy. And surprise, surprise, they run the economy to help the giant banks, to help the biggest corporations, to help the investor class, not to help everybody else.
That was kind of Bernie Sanders' message in the primaries last year. You stayed studiously neutral in those primaries, given the fact that his campaign was predicated on that very notion. What caused you to stay out of that race?
So, you know, always remember that these are, we had two primaries going on simultaneously, and the Republicans really were, it was a clown car over there, right? As they just kept piling out and doing all kinds of crazy stuff and, you know, lurched from one crazy issue to another. You know, kind of the who was going to get voted off the island stuff that you kept watching. It was a time when I was actually really proud to be a Democrat, because Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were out debating issues, and they talked about how we should pay for education in America, you know, what priority it should have. They talked about health care. They talked about trade. They talked about all those issues. And I thought during the primary, for me, it was to keep urging them on to have this debate, to get America to pay attention to this set of issues, to draw people out and to say, I like Bernie because of this issue, or I like Hillary because of that issue. It made me proud to be a Democrat.
Do you think that in the general election campaign that Democrats writ large and the ticket emphasized these economic issues? Was there a clear economic message from your perspective?
Not nearly enough. No. I mean, as I said in the book, you know, we obviously didn't make the sale in the election. Now, look, Hillary Clinton did get 3 million more votes than Donald Trump in any democracy on the face of this earth other than ours. She would be the president of the country. But I get what the rules are. And I also get that we really didn't get out there to a lot of working people and make it clear. Here's the difference between being a Democrat and being a Republican. And, you know, you watch this right now in Washington, this health care bill that the Republicans are writing behind closed doors. 13 men will not let anyone else in.
That.
Can we talk about that for
well,
a second?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. I'll do this on
because it could be that this week,
yeah,
as early as this week, there'll be a vote on a rewrite of the health care law.
That we haven't seen.
That will come without a public hearing.
Exactly.
And that you haven't yet seen because Senator McConnell has exercised a rule within the Senate,
yep,
rules that allows him to do that.
But for me, right there, look at the health care bill, the one that came from the House, that got a majority, got all the nearly all the Republicans in the House and no Democrats. And there's the big difference between what it means to be a Republican and what it means to be a Democrat. So the Republicans say, I know, here's how we're going to reform health care in America. We're going to knock 23 million people off their health care coverage. We're going to raise costs for everybody over 50. We're going to open the door to discriminating against people who have pre-existing conditions or mental health issues or opioid addiction. And why? Why would you do all that? So that you could give tax breaks to a handful of millionaires and billionaires. Okay, that's what it means to be a Republican. Democrats have said, look, we believe in coverage for everybody. We're trying to aim in that direction, and we're trying to bring costs down for everyone. Have we gotten it perfect in the Affordable Care Act? No, but we're sure headed in that direction. And yeah, we're willing to work on it right now, right now. I've got a bill pending with Bernie and others to say prescription drugs. We really need to bring down the price of prescription drugs. One way we could do that is let's import from Canada.
Something the president said he wanted to
exactly
do.
Exactly right. Let's import from Canada. So, but here's the heart of it. Democrats believe that healthcare is a basic human right and that it is government's job to help make sure there's coverage and to help bring down costs. Republicans say, hey, it's more important to have tax breaks for those at the top than it is to have health care coverage for everyone else.
Is it going to?
There's the difference.
Is it your sense that McConnell has the 50 votes he needs?
You know, look, I don't think it's guaranteed. That's why I'm in this fight. That's why I want everybody who hears this to be in this fight. This is the clang, clang, clang. Let's sound all the alarms, all hands on deck. We got to be in this fight and push on the Republicans. We got 48 votes on our side. The Democrats and the independents are saying no to the kind of bill they passed over in the House. But we got to pick up a few Republicans who care more about providing health care coverage to millions of Americans than about giving tax breaks to some billionaires.
At the risk of running out this conversation, and I don't want to because I got a couple of other things to ask you about, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the repeal of Dodd-Frank that passed the House last week. And we should point out that there were elements of that bill with which you were deeply involved. You really helped create the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau.
You and the president were also deeply involved in it.
In fairness, the idea was predicated on something that you'd been advocating for a decade. Going into great detail, what would the impact of that passage of that bill be?
So two or three key points in it. The first one is costs would go up on loans. Can you believe this? On student loans, on mortgages, because it's got this mathematical formula in it that would just force people to pay more. Unbelievable. Second part is we leveled the playing field with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We're not all the way there, but helped. That agency has now been in place for 5 years, and it has forced the biggest banks in this country to return more than $12 billion directly to people they cheated. Now, that's government that works for the people. It's handled more than 1 million complaints. By the way, if anyone's listening and they've got a complaint, a credit card company that won't reverse a $10 charge or a bank that won't give back $14,000 in a down payment on a mortgage that didn't go through, go to cfpb.gov and you can file a complaint. You can also check out who's gotten complaints. It's an open database that you can look at, helping level the playing field. What they want to do is they want to take the consumer watchdog and leash it up. So that's the second part. And then the third part is they want to say, hey, let's get rid of a big chunk of those regulations that are there for the biggest financial institutions. Remember the ones that broke the economy and
yes,
had to have
I remember.
A
I was
you
there.
Remember
yes,
them
yeah.
right had to have a $700 billion bailout, cost the economy an estimated $14 trillion in people losing their homes, their jobs, their savings. They want to say, let's roll back those protections to where they were before the crash. What could possibly go wrong? You know, you just want to say to these guys, are you for real? I get that you've completely sold out to the big financial institutions, but you think you can go home and say to the people who elected you to come to Washington that, hey, my big achievement for this year was to turn loose the biggest financial institutions to let them roll over this economy and blow it up one
more
time?
How much of that could pass the Senate?
I don't know. Because
they would need 60 votes for that, right?
Well, I think they will need 60 votes for that. And that means it's going to be harder for them to do it. On the other hand, they're going to pick them off wherever they can, pick off votes from the Democrats. This is one of those, if everybody gets what's at stake here, the Republicans have no chance. But on the other hand, if everybody gets what's at stake here, they never would have passed the House to begin with.
This town is not consumed by these issues, which are getting too little attention. But and not to suggest that what's going on relative to the Russia investigation shouldn't get attention. But it's there's such absorption with that that it's hard to get other messages through. As we sit here tomorrow, your old colleague, Jeff Sessions, mm-hmm. will be testifying publicly before the House the Senate Intelligence Committee. What was your impression of Jim Comey's testimony last week? And what is your impression of Sessions and his conduct before and as Attorney General?
Yeah, I thought Comey was pretty straight. He got out there and was a straight shooter. in trying to tell what had happened and to leave it to the United States Congress to decide what the implications are of what he said. Sessions, look, I oppose Sessions for being Attorney General of the United States. And you may remember.
You got shut down for trying.
I got sent away from the Senate for that and got shut down and not allowed to speak again until after the vote. That was the rule. I could not speak again until the Senate had had a chance to vote on Jeff Sessions. And then when it came out that Jeff Sessions had lied to Congress, had lied to the Senate during his confirmation hearing, I called again. He needs to be fired. He needs to be taken out of that job. If you're not going to be honest during your confirmation hearing, then you ought to be gone. So what did he say to try to tamp down the rising anger? He said, well, I'll recuse myself from anything to do with the Russia investigation, since that's what he had lied about. And then, according to Comey's testimony last week, it looks like Jeff Sessions was somehow in the middle of all this. So that's what we'll learn more about tomorrow. But
well, we know he was involved in the firing.
Exactly. We know he was right in the middle of it. That's a matter of public record now. And Donald Trump himself, I think, has said
And would that be, in your view, given the fact that Trump said that he fired Comey because of the Russia investigation, would Sessions being involved in that be a violation of his recusal, in your view?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me ask you about the Democratic Party. I'm not going to ask you whether you're going to run for president in 2020 because I don't want to put that quarter in and get the recording. And I know you're up for re-election in 2018. But tell me what you think the Democratic Party has to do and what kind of candidate the Democratic Party needs to field to be successful in 2020.
I think we need to get out there and talk about our values. And for me, the heart of that is about opportunity, what we've been talking about for nearly an hour now. The Republicans think the world is supposed to run for those at the top, and that's the heart of trickle-down, right? And somehow the rest of you will get along fine. Democrats believe everybody counts, and that means we make investments to give opportunities to everybody, to all our kids, to our people. We try to build a country that works not just for those at the top, but that works for the rest of us. We try to build a country that's about strengthening the middle class, not only so the middle class is strong, but so that people who aren't there yet, people like my family right out at the edges, have the opportunity to make it in. There are open doors. There are real opportunities. And it's to drive home, this is what the Democrats have got to do, to drive home that those values are values that we believe all the way to our toes, and we will get out there and fight for them. We won't just sit around and talk about them. We'll get out there and fight for them.
And do you see people out there, present company excluded, because I already said I'm not going to ask you about that, but are there people out there who you think are delivering that message, will deliver that message? Are you confident that that's because, you know, you read the Times did a story the other day about the civil war within the Democratic Party and so on. Do you perceive that?
You know, I don't, David. I don't see this as a civil war. I think when we talk about these core economic issues that for me are the real heart of what it means to be a Democrat, this how we value people, I think that's what brings us together as a party. I think that's what it means to be a Democrat.
There may be differences in how you implement that, but not in the overall value statement.
The value statement and the willingness to fight for it statement. For mm-hmm. me, that's, you know, that's the heart of the whole thing.
You had to, I know I wrote an autobiography, and it was an interesting exercise because you find yourself thinking about your life in ways you'd never thought about them before, and much more deeply and profoundly about experiences that you have. How often do you find yourself kind of looking back at where you came from and asking yourself how this happened?
You know, writing this book really was an exercise in rethinking parts of your life that you just accept and move on. All three of my brothers served in the military. My oldest brother was career military.
And one of them flew like 288
sorties. Combat missions in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, yeah.
For long, long years in our family, we would not know from day to day where my brother was and whether he was safe. That's one of those things that just gets woven into your life, the idea of public service. All three of my brothers went into the military, and it's a kind of course they did. That's how they served. You asked the question, were my parents political? And the answer was no, but the answer is also yes. My grandmother got her little check from the government, and that was the check. She lived with my Aunt Bee. She lived with us sometimes. She lived with my Uncle Travis and Aunt Lucy sometimes, and Aunt Alice and
We're
Uncle Claude.
We're now lapsing into an episode of Andy of Mayberry. That's,
yeah, all right, all
you
right.
You started with Aunt Bee.
That's right. Yes. Aunt Bee carried me home from the hospital. I'm married. I'm named after Aunt Bee. Aunt Bee's always been there. She never had children, and I was her baby too. But
what do you think your mom would say about you now?
I think most of all, my mother would be, she would approve that I not only had a family and taken care of my family and with my husband, I'm divorced and remarried, but and our kids, but also that I'm close with my brothers. And that they mean a lot to me, and we help each other in lots of different ways. But we're there, and I think that's something. My mother was very big on you help family, and then when you've helped family, you help neighbors, and when you've helped neighbors, then you help the town. That's what my mom did.
And what's that thing that your dad said to you when things were? We're glum.
You know, life gets better, Punkin.
Yeah.
That's always the story that for me ties all of this together. It's like you said about when you write your own story, when you go back and try to write your
right.
biography. The story about my mother going off to work after my daddy had a heart attack and we've lost the family car. We're about to lose the house. It's right down to the wire. And she pulls on her best dress and she's crying and she walks to the Sears and she gets a job, a minimum wage job at the Sears. And that job saves our house and it saves our family. And I always thought of that story as a story of a woman with grit and, you know, she got out there and did what she needed to do for her family, and our family held together. And it was in writing this book that it's like you turn the cube around and look at it from a different direction. And I saw two parts to it that had not been so obvious to me. The first was what it had meant to my daddy, not to be able to provide for us. But the second was how, when I was a kid, a minimum wage job would keep a family of three afloat. That's how it was designed. That was the filter that this Congress right here in Washington used, and that is set the minimum wage where a family, one person working 40 hours a week can keep a family of three just above water, just hanging on. And today, a mama and a baby cannot survive on a minimum wage job. There is nowhere in America that they can rent a two-bedroom apartment on a minimum wage job 40 hours a week. And this Congress right here in Washington, yeah, it looks at the minimum wage. It looks at it in terms of the profitability of McDonald's and Walmart, not in whether or not somebody working 40 hours a week can keep themselves and a little family out of poverty. And that's when I understood it up. Bam, hit you right in the face moment. That the reason my family survived back when I was a little girl was because of policies set right here in Washington. And the reason many families just like mine are failing today is because of policies set right here in Washington. Those are the choices we make as a country. Those are the choices we make every time we go out to vote. And that is the reason I am in this fight all the way. We got to make these choices to make this country work for our
people. This fight is our fight is the name of the book, Senator Elizabeth Warren. I can't ask another question because that seemed like a great summation of your point here. And always great to be with you. Always great to chat.
It's always good to visit with you, David.
Thank you.
Let's do it.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.